Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Christopher Scott, and I'm here with Kathleen van de Berge.
Hi.
Hi. You're from the Loire Valley and Berge, and we were talking to you last week about Berge, but I wanted to talk a wee bit about some of your wines, because it's all Cabernet Franc.
Yes.
So in theory, there shouldn't be really much going on here. There should be Cabernet Franc, maybe a slightly more austere Cabernet Franc, blah, 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 blah. But you've got a reasonable range of wines. I haven't tried them, so I'll be straight up and down. I have tried your sparkling Cabernet Franc, which we'll talk about a little bit. But do you want to just tell us a quick overview of your wine range, and then we'll drill into some questions I have for you?
I have to say, right from the start, when we bought Minière, I don't know whether it's my inquisitive mind, but I was always very interested to see how much different wines I can make with one grape, or different products even, because I also make grape juice. So it was really trial and error. We made some wines that we no longer make, but I wanted to see how much wine styles of the world I could make with this one grape. So that's also where the range comes from, I think.
Did you ever make a white wine from it?
We are making a sparkling white wine, which is on the lease right now, yes.
Okay.
And I also once made a sweet wine, which was not a success, but at least I tried.
Why was it not a success, the sweet wine?
No, it was really... But of course, we also tried it in a bad year. It was not the ideal vintage. I think it was 2012. And it really, no, it was just not worth selling it, no. But at least we tried. I'm really intrigued of what can we do and why are some grapes better suited than others. So now at least I know, which is also why now I make Chenin Blanc and sweet wine. But Cabernet Franc, I don't think is made for making sweet wine. I mean, sweet wine in the sense of drying on the vines and late harvest. No, it wasn't made for that, no.
But you make a sweet wine from Chenin Blanc. I presume you buy the grapes in, is that right?
No, we bought a second estate in Quart de Chaume with Chenin Blanc, 7 hectares of Chenin Blanc.
Oh, okay. And you're using that to make a sweet wine.
And I make sweet wine and dry wine.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, that makes sense. I'm more of a Cabernet Franc guy, so we're going to talk about Cabernet Franc today. So you've got a couple of rosés, a sweetie, and some grape juice.
Yes.
So let's start with the grape juice, because it's the one that's least interesting.
Yes, so grape juice is probably also started from a trial of how can we make good grape juice, because honestly, there's not so much good grape juice on the market. All wineries sell grape juice, but my kids, who often visit wineries with us as well, were often not impressed by the grape juice. So the idea was also to try a fruity, sweet grape juice, not too sweet, but naturally sweet. And it's really good. We really like it. It's also flash pasteurized, so no preservatives, no... nothing chemical in it. And the advantage of the grape juice, the use of the grape juice for us is also to dose the sparkling wines. So we make grape juice to sell in bottles, but we also make it for our sparkling wine production.
Okay.
Which is a big part of the production.
Yeah. So your sparkling wine, let's touch on the sparkling wine because it's a little bit unusual. It's a sparkling red wine. And it's normally only the Australians who make that abomination. do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Of course, mine is not an abomination. So the sparkling red also came from the same inquisitive mind, I think. Before we had Minière, my husband and I regularly drank Lambrusco on a sweet summer day when it was really
Italian.
Too hot to drink a real red wine, because we're really red wine drinkers. So when it's hot and you don't want to drink a heavy red wine, you drink a sparkling sweet red wine. But we thought the Lambrusco was too sweet, and so we wanted to try and make that with Cabernet Franc in a version that is more appealing. And so we started with that in 2011. So our second vintage, we already made the first trial, 500 bottles of sweet red wine, sparkling red wine. And it's really not very sweet, honestly, because that's what we try to avoid, to make it very sweet. So we make it so that it's... not too much tannins in the red base wine, so that we don't have to add too much sweetness in the final blend to make it balanced.
Yeah.
And all sweetness comes from our own grape juice, which is probably also why it's well integrated and balanced, I think. It's all grapes from the estate, nothing external.
Okay, so you're using your you look at the Expedition, if you want to use
it. Yes, our grape juice, yeah.
It's grape juice that from you're using. It's like almost like a Swiss reserve then, isn't it?
A bit, yeah, indeed, because it's indeed our own fresh grape juice, yeah. And a fresh pasteurized, because otherwise
it
wouldn't.
So how do you make it? Because I noticed it said it is a pétillant naturel.
Yeah, so the rosé is a real pétillant naturel, and the red wine is a bit of a mix in between both. The red one, we really make first a red wine, but we don't make a standard red wine like our other red wines, because that would be way too much tannin. So we try to make a base red wine, as I said, with as little tannin as possible.
So like cold soaking and
we do a part cold soak and a part carbonic maceration.
Oh, carbonic maceration as well,
for really reduction of tannin. And I really want a lot of aromas. And as you taste, it's very aromatic.
Yeah, deep, a lot
and,
of forest
floor. And a lot of color as well. And carbonic maceration allows for color and aromas and not too much tannin. But only carbonic maceration would make it too...
bubblegummy.
Yeah, and it wouldn't age well on the lees. So that's why we mix half... Only not half, because the blend changes every year, but part cold soak and part carbonic maceration indeed, yeah.
Okay, because the advantage of cold soak is you get the colour...
And structure also, some structure.
But not necessarily the tannins.
Yeah.
Okay.
And but still it's more structured than a carbonic maceration, yeah.
So just to the audience, cold soaking is when you crush the juice, crush the berries, leave them in contact with the juice before you do fermentation. Yeah. And whereas if you do it after fermentation when the alcohol's really high... It's really extractive, and you'll get a lot more tannins coming out when high alcohol's coming through. And also, as the fermentation occurs, the juice gets warmer, and that helps extraction as well. So, do you press after the cold soak? So you've just and then you
and
start
we
fermentation.
We anyway separate, but that's on all our wines. We separate the how you call it, the leek juice and the pressed juice, the free run juice and the pressed juice always. And then the final blend is made by cold soak, carbonic maceration, free run juice and pressed juice. And that's how we determine then the blend. Before and then we bottle again for the second fermentation. We bottle the wine for the second fermentation with some yeast and with grape juice to start the second fermentation. So in that sense, it's a bit of a traditional method because it's a second fermentation. And then it stays on the lees for quite a while. And we see that the longer it stays on the lees in the bottle, the more integrated and the softer it gets, and also the less sugar we have to add at dosage. So it stays on lees almost 2 years, often 2 years. It depends a bit on our sales, honestly.
But now
we're on a rhythm of 2 years, and then we disgorge it and add grape juice to balance the tannins from the red wine. But the idea really is that you don't taste the sweetness.
Yeah.
And it just balances off the tannins.
I don't really notice any autolic flavors, no yeasty, bready notes in the wine.
Well, I think that comes from the bottle aging, indeed. It's not as pronounced, indeed, as on the rosé wine. The red wine with its tannins and all its structural elements must indeed give other flavors, more these earthy tones. Mm-hmm. Indeed, you don't smell the otolytic, although it is only as long as the rosé where you smell it more clearly. But I also have to say that I make all my wines in the style that I like them. I'm not a big fan of otolytic character. I'm more a fan of fruity, fresh wines that smell and taste like the grape variety.
Yeah.
So I'm not unhappy that you don't have that, honestly. I prefer that you have this jammy red fruit burst when you put your nose in the glass, right? Okay. That's really what I'm looking for.
I thought natural pétillants or pétillants, what do you call it? Pétillants naturel?
Pétillant naturel.
Pétillants naturel was where it was what natural wine people did when they were bored and they just sort of left a bit of sugar in the juice, and then it went on to a crazy secondary fermentation without any control, and it's not a fault, it's a sparkling wine I made.
That's probably how they found out about it. So our rosé sparkling is a real pétillant naturel in the sense, and that's also what you describe is linked to that, but we really try to control whatever we do and not have hazards arriving. So the rosé, we first harvest direct pressing, and because we always, all our rosés are direct pressing, and the wine starts to ferment in the tank, and then we stop the fermentation while there's still some sugar in the wine. We bottle the wine, and the fermentation continues in the bottle, and that fermentation then creates the sparkle in the bottle. And so there's no correction at the bottling. It's a wine that continues in the bottle. And that's the definition of pétillant naturel, in the sense that the grapes create the sugar, the alcohol and the pétillant, and the bubbles.
Yeah, okay.
And the pétillant also means that it's 3-bar rather than 6-bar, like a crémant and a champagne.
Yep.
It's more 6-bar, so quite aggressive sparkle, where a pétillant is more lower pressure, more 3-bar.
Yeah, more like an Italian Fezzenti or something like that. So
maybe not as little, but indeed more. And for me, therefore, it's more a wine and less an aperitif, so it's less aggressive. It's more a wine that you can have food with.
Yeah, okay. And do you find the bubbles, just that little bit of pétillance, gives you a fresher style of wine, or...?
Yes, indeed, yeah. It's more, it's of course also festive, and bubbles is always nice as well.
Yeah.
But indeed, it of course creates different aromas in the wine as well. And the bubbles make that other aromas come out of your glass.
Actually, I was just thinking, your sparkling red, which is what I'm drinking, that would probably go right with turkey. Do you...
You could have it with light meat, yes, indeed. Yeah. Well, even with barbecue. In summer, we have it with barbecue. And because it's still a red wine with tannins. So you can still have meat with it, and still Cabernet Franc, which honestly pairs very well with meat all around. So, and it's a refreshing red wine, and that's also how I like to see it, because we often just leave it out on the table and it warms up a bit, but that's fine. It's a light red wine.
Okay, and some of the wines you've got are old vine wines.
Yes.
I saw one that you've got, some of the vines are 100 years old.
Yeah.
That's quite a long time. Yeah. Most people would replace those by
then. Yeah,
why have you... Because as vines get older, the yield decreases and it becomes less and less commercial. And normally around 50 years, they start going, do you know what? Let's actually make some money now. And they grub it up and put some new stuff in and up the yield a little bit. But you guys are on 100-year-old. What's going on there?
So in fact, when we bought Minière and we had 18 hectares... we noticed that the average age of the vineyard then was 45 years. So that meant that the big part of the vineyard was well over 50 years. And the reason for me, because of course I don't know the whole history of what the people did, but for me the reason was that it was a holiday home for a rich family who lived in Paris. And they didn't really invest in the winery. They just rented it out. A local winemaker made the wines. And they just got some bottles in exchange. But if a vineyard needs to be replaced, it's the owners who need to pay for it. So for me, they decided they wouldn't pay for that. They just let the vines grow. And therefore, the vines were not replaced as indeed a normal winemaker would. Because that's indeed what the normal people would do if they look at yield and economic results. So I suppose that is what was happening. Anyway, the previous people from whom we bought the estate, that was surely what was happening, because they didn't have the money to replace the vineyard. So it's a bit of a... For us, it's also, of course, an opportunity, because old vines are indeed interesting, but not all old vines are interesting. But then, so in the beginning, we didn't change anything. We just kept going with the vineyard that we had, and we started to select the best plots to make our old vine wine. And only now, since 2 years, are we really ripping up vineyard and replacing old vines. But we of course still have many, because we started with over 10 hectares of super old vines, even more than that. So indeed we have one wine, which is the Chateau de Minière, which is made from vines of 50 to 60 year old vines, which is really a majority of the original vineyard that we have, and which are also on the slopes that I mentioned earlier, towards the forest and the limestone. And then indeed we had 2 plots, and by now 3, because we bought a few extra, of super old vines, really super old vines. It's between 90 and 110 years old. They're really super old, and you can also see it when you see them. And indeed, lots of vines are missing in those plots. So we have low yield because we have few vines in those vineyards. In fact, the individual vines still give a normal yield, but the fact that we don't have... that is not fully planted makes that we have low yield in those vineyards. But we keep them because the vines are super good. They give very concentrated juice, and we really, our Vin Centenaire is really a very, very interesting wine. So we keep those 3 plots now. I don't know until when, because there will indeed come a moment when it's no longer useful to make wine of those. But we keep them. And of course, I suppose, we have to see how that evolves. Our 50, 60, 70 year old vineyards will probably also evolve into those interesting vineyards over time. So I hope we can get into some sort of system that we can keep that single cuvée going of the super old vines. Of course, we only have like 4,000 bottles of that super old wine, so it's not a mass market cuvée that we make there.
Do you hand harvest or machine harvest?
We mostly, all the wines of Mijere that you see there are hand harvested. Of course.
So you could replant new vines into the gaps where the old vines have died and still keep the integrity of the old vines and increase your yield. I'm just devil's advocate.
But that's what in 100-year-old vines, that doesn't make sense. You can't. The young vine can never, ever, ever compete with these old vines.
Oh, no, but you can get, you know, you can. You said that the old vines were still producing decent yields,
yeah.
But because there's holes in the rows, because the vines have
many
just
holes.
Died,
yes.
You could replant those holes with young vines, new vines, which would then give you, if you're hand harvesting, you just don't, when you haven't harvested for the old one.
I see what you mean.
And then you can get the young vines for your cuvée.
I'm told, and then we don't replant in between the super old vines. There's just no point. I'm told that there's they would never survive because they can't compete in that soil between these very old vines. The young vines could never develop into interesting vines in between these super old vines. So we don't plant in between the super old vines. What we will do at some point is just rip it all up and replant. I hope we can still postpone that decision, but that's what we will be doing over time, yeah.
Okay.
Of course, we replant young vines in between the younger vineyards. That's what we do every year. And otherwise, when we, in Mijere, there were also several plots of 50, 60-year-old vines with lots of missing vines as well because people hadn't invested. We just ripped that up, replanted completely. There's no point, really, in planting super young vines in between super old vines. That just doesn't give anything interesting.
Okay, I'll play along. How much does the yield drop away? You know, you've got young vines, you've got old 50-year-old and very old.
Of course, it's in Loire, we are very dependent on the climate. So anyway, yield is never a constant, and it's very big variation. I would say that the old vines, we go to 10 to 15 hectoliters per hectare.
Yeah.
Something around that. The old vines, so the Château de Minière, honestly, I don't know it by heart now, but it would be around 20, 25.
Yep.
While the super young vines, we should be higher than we are, because as I said, we have an average, still very old vineyard. We should reach more or less the maximum of the appellation. We should be around 55. I'm sure we're still not there, but that should be our commercial objective, because those are, especially after we have replanted, there will be young vines that will just produce normal yields.
Yeah, okay.
That's anyway the objective.
So 40, 50 hectolitres, 25, and then 10, 15.
Yeah.
10, 15, that is a big drop, isn't it?
Yeah. That's really a choice to make an interesting wine.
Yeah.
And go for concentration and something different. And of course, economically, because the bottle is now at 25, doesn't make sense still, but Loire wines are, of course, there's also market price to take into account. If you look at the real cost, you should price it at 40 or 50 euros because it also spends a year and a half on barrel. So it's a high effort wine, but it's just worthwhile to make something special. It's also a bit of an iconic wine. It's also what people associate us with. It's the, how you call it, the stamp of our estate.
Unique selling point.
Yeah, also.
USP. Okay. Okay, and so you do a little bit of oak aging on some of your more top-end wines.
So the Chateau, the old vines, is aged for around a year. It depends on the vintage, but only in old barrels and only part of the wine. So around one-third to half of the wine goes in used barrels, but not super old barrels, like wine barrels of 2, 3, 4 years. The Centenaire goes completely in barrel every year.
Which one?
The Vigne Centenaire, so the 100-year-old vines.
Oh, yeah.
That goes completely in barrel. And of these barrels, we always have every year a few new ones, like 2 to 3 new barrels every year. I don't want oak flavor at all, but the oak helps to structure the wine and allow it to age over time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, a bit of sweetness and tannins as well, which is quite nice.
And our young red, the Rouge, is only in stainless. The idea there is to make a fruity, young wine that can be drank immediately, and there's no oak whatsoever in that wine.
Yeah, okay, so that's the reds. The rosé, You've got a rosé. Is it Bourgogne rosé or is it?
Yes, in Bourgogne, rosé is part of the appellation, as it in Chinon.
Yeah,
and it's increasingly important in Bourgogne. They really make a point of promoting it. And for me personally, rosé is super important because we used to drink only red wine. And rosé was a bit my white wine. When we had fish, I had rosé. And I want to make a quality rosé wine, which is a challenge. And it's a direct pressing of the grapes as well. It's made like a white wine, so temperature controlled, only in stainless, to really make it super fruity. And it's completely dry, so it's bone dry with good fresh acidity. So it's really like a white wine, but in a rosé style.
I haven't seen the wine, but I've seen the pictures of the bottles, and they're very the real trend at the moment is have those super light Provence colored rosés. Everybody seems to be going down that route, but you've
That's what we have now as well, indeed.
Oh, you do. Yeah. Your pictures are out of date.
Part of my my quest over time was also to make a paler rosé. It's really an association because in the end, for the taste, it doesn't matter, but it's what people associate.
Yeah,
and it's
indeed
also an aesthetic question, aesthetics. The eye, for me, is as important as the nose and the palate. So we changed a lot our harvesting system to handle the grapes as little as possible. So even in manual harvest, the grapes are still thrown around, so to say. Mm. So we changed that a lot to handle them as little as possible. And when they come into the press, there's hardly any color yet on the grapes. So then we press them immediately and it's really, really light colored now.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's so light colored that our sparkling rosé of 2015 is in fact white.
Yeah.
So that's why we will probably make a Blanc de Noir sparkling.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So that was... It was supposed to be a rosé, but it's ended up going to be a white.
Yeah, yes.
Oh,
yes,
okay.
Yes.
Do you think you'll keep with that, or do you think you'll just be a bit more rough with the grapes later on?
Well, that's indeed, it's a good question. It's a good question. So, anyway, the rosé, for me, should be rosé, honestly. Some people make a white Cabernet Franc, but I prefer that the rosé is a rosé and that the white wine is a white wine. On the sparkling, I'm a bit more open because the Blanc de Noir can be interesting, even commercially and visually it can be interesting. So it's still up for debate because it's still in the cellar waiting to be disgorged. So we're still debating that. Because at the dosage with the grape juice, it will anyway get some color. So
I was going to say, at dosage, look at this.
So we're just, and that's the whole debate, we're thinking of making it brut nature, so not no dosage at all and keeping it white.
Okay.
So that's the whole thing.
And even though it's white, there's no problems with it being Bourgogne?
I know, but the sparkling is anyway not Bourgogne. The sparkling is Vin de France, so we do whatever we want.
Well, you do what you like.
Yes,
that's
indeed.
True.
That's true.
And what about your rosé? If it gets really lighter and lighter and lighter until it's almost virtually a white wine, does it lose the appellation at that point?
I think that's a very good question, and I asked myself that question when we ended up with the white sparkling, and honestly, I don't know, but that's typical wine law. You make the wine like you should, and you end up white, but that's not allowed, so you're a bit stuck. Wine law doesn't allow for for these cases, I think.
And the French, and with rosé, the French law says you can't add red wine
to
it.
Yes, you can't add red wine, so you make it like you should, but you can't adjust it, so you're stuck, so... Let's say that I prefer not to have that problem because it's a typical French debate indeed. Yeah.
All right then, Kathleen, I think we'll wrap it up there.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Cheers.